So welcome everybody to today's episode of the Independent Teacher Podcast, and I'm really pleased to be joined by two guests today, and they are both part of a wonderful organisation called End Sexism in Schools. So I've got, first of all, the founder, Debbie Brazil, and I've also got Rachel Fenn, who's done lots of work and some projects on English, the English curriculum. So hello and welcome to today's show.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Now, first of all, could you just tell our listeners about the movement, who's involved, why you set it up, and obviously what your mission is going forwards?
So basically, schools and the education system aren't really different from any other institution that you come across. Basically, male privilege shape and underpin everything about schools, and they create a culture and an environment where sexism is normalised and flourishes. And for me, I'm a parent, I'm not a teacher. And for me, I've watched my sons go through the school system. They're nearly finished, but not quite. And I just saw that every aspect of it, well, so much of it was sexist, basically looking at the invisibility of women and girls in what they're taught every day. And if you think about English and history and the everyday lessons they're taught in the curriculum, that women and girls are invisible. And you find that really they're only valuing what men did in history and what men wrote about. Only those voices are seen as worthy of teaching. And it just reflects what happens in the rest of society in truth. You know, they're supported by exam boards that leave women out or put complicated women's books on. And basically the curriculum and the syllabi just perpetuate it. And, you know, obviously you get the gender directing of girls and boys to subjects that are traditionally considered to be suitable for girls and boys. I see resources directed disproportionately towards the boys from playground space. How often, you know, your image of the girls playing around the edges and the boys playing football in the middle and the girls having to run away from the ball as it comes towards them. But even the school discipline system, if you think about it, you know, if you read reports from UK Feminista and there was a Women's Parliamentary report a few years ago, not that long ago, and the recent Everyone's Invited report that Ofsted did, they all show that even when girls do take concerns about even things like sexism and sexual harassment to teachers, it's trivialised. And if you think about it, it's just like the wider their school discipline system effectively mirrors the wider legal system when women take concerns in wider life. You know, we get ignored, trivialised, you know, it's just banter. As we know with the police, they don't take women's complaints seriously. So the truth is schools are just the same as any other institution. They're sexist from the inside to the outside. And to be fair to schools, why wouldn't they be? They just reflect society. When I came across various things with my children, I'm a very big feminist and I tried to do something about it. I tried to raise it with the schools, but I just basically found they resisted changing the status quo. So, you know, to cut a long story short, I realised I needed to find allies and that I couldn't do this by myself, and I couldn't find any other existing organisation that was really doing much around schools. Amazingly, you would just assume there must be, but there is. I couldn't find it, and I, you know, if they're out there, get in touch, because I don't know if they are, who they are. So I decided to try and find my own allies, and I set End Sexism in Schools up. I found allies through running a fringe session. It's a Women's Equality Party conference back in 2020, and it was all online and with COVID. But I found an amazing group of women, of which Rachel came very shortly after that, into the organisation. And what we're about is demanding change at every level, structural change around schools. We're all about ending sexism in schools. So we are what it says on the tin. We are interested in all levels of education, from primary school to secondary school and even nurseries. But we're a group of volunteers at the moment and we had to start somewhere. So we start with secondary schools. We want to challenge those who design the curriculum content, whether that's DfE, exam boards, Ofqual. We want to challenge what schools read, the books they read, because one of the things people may not realise is that before pre-GCSE, schools can actually choose to read what they like, and yet they still read the same old stuff. We want to challenge how Ofsted inspect for equality and for sexism, which they don't really, at least as long as Ofsted exists for, who knows what's going to happen there. But really, the thing for us is no one's really challenging schools and the wider system about sexism, and we think it just goes unnoticed. It's under the radar. So that's why I started the movement, and we are going to be that voice for change. And Rachel, as I say, joined me at the start of the journey, and we now have a team, and we do work on several fronts. So in essence, we aim to challenge the system at national system level. So as I say, we're looking to lobby MPs and government, get the law changed, and challenge the exam board. And the other thing that we aim to do is to provide resources to schools to help them change, because ultimately you'll have schools and teachers who would change, maybe don't know how, and haven't got the time, even if they did know how. And so our aim is to try and help produce lesson plans, whole lesson plans and whole term lesson plans, to help them see how to bring women and girls back into the curriculum. So that's broadly what the campaign is aiming to do and what we're about.
And I'll come back to some of that a little bit later on in the programme, where we try to assess how optimistic you are about the changes that you're trying to introduce. But what I wanted to do now is to talk to Rachel, because I picked up in the, I think it was The Guardian, an interview that they'd done with you back in March about some of the work that you'd done. So I want to touch on some of those projects that you've been involved with. So if we just start with the Key Stage 3 English curriculum, and this is in maintained schools, could you just tell us a little bit about what your research has indicated about the English curriculum?
Yeah, so this research report that we did is actually the first of its type that's ever been carried out, which we were also surprised by, that no one had done this. As Debbie mentioned earlier, Key Stage 3 in English is a kind of free-for-all for teachers. There's no set text list, there's no options that you have to take, apart from Shakespeare. You have to do Shakespeare at least twice. Anyone else, obviously a man, anyone else, you can do what you like. So we trying to find the statistics behind what teachers are studying is really hard, because, as I say, anybody could be doing anything. So that's one of the reasons, I think, why no one's done this research before. So what we did is get together a whole group of volunteers who contacted schools or researched their websites. Schools have to publish their curriculum on their website. Not all of them did. So the ones that we couldn't find, we had to contact directly, and we managed to research about a third of the secondary schools in England, and that was a kind of really big eye-opener for us. We knew that we would find sexism, but we didn't realize the extent that we would find. So some of the top line statistics are that 77% of schools teach only one or no whole texts written by women, and the average of texts taught over the Key Stage 3 is about 9 per school. You tend to do about 3 whole texts per year. So considering that you look at like those sorts of statistics and you're thinking about what students are studying in their classes, most students for the whole of Key Stage 3 are not reading anything written by a woman that's longer than a poem. Normally, women are often relegated to just poetry or extracts. When we looked at the actual content of the novels read, 82% of the novels studied had a male protagonist. And what we found was that the vast majority of male-authored books have male protagonists, but for female authors, it's about 50-50 male-female protagonists. So even when teachers are choosing books authored by a woman, often the protagonist in that book is still a man. So when you're having discussions in the classroom about the characters and how they're feeling, etc., you're still talking about a male perspective, even if that male is written by a woman. So something that we really are keen to stress is how important the protagonist of the text is. It's not just about choosing a female author and thinking that you've done your job. You have to look about what's actually in the text and what the students are going to spend their time talking about. Because most of the time in the classroom, I should say also, I am an English teacher, so I do speak with some knowledge here. Most of the time in the classroom, you're not talking about the author, you're talking about the characters, particularly at Key Stage 3. What we also found that was really interesting, as I've mentioned, schools have free choice. However, what we found was that most schools are teaching the same pool of 5 novels across Key Stage 3. So those 5 top novels are Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, Animal Farm by George Orwell, Boy in the Striped Pyjamas by John Boyne, and Lord of the Flies by William Golding. And no prizes for guessing the common denominator between all of these texts is that they are all written by white men, and they all feature male protagonists. Something that I found quite surprising and disappointing as an English teacher is also that those books are consistently popular across all year groups. So you've got students in year seven studying the same texts that other students are studying in year nine. So thinking about what is the appropriateness of these texts for the year groups that are studying them. A lot of teachers, we had quite a lot of discussion around Advice and Men with teachers because we did some teacher surveys to try and find out why teachers were teaching what they were choosing to teach. And lots of teachers told us that, oh, yes, but we know Advice and Men's misogynist and racist. But the thing is, it's really great to have these conversations with the students. It's a really good discussion point to have. Our argument coming back to that is, well, you could just teach them something that's maybe not racist or misogynistic, or teach a book by a woman or teach a book by an author of colour to have those conversations. But what was really interesting is teachers saying that to us, and then I would say back to them, but do you really think a year seven is capable of having that discussion? Do you really think a year seven is able to look at a quite a challenging depiction of a woman who is murdered for being flirtatious, and then the tears at the end of the novel are for the man who murdered her? And be able to sit and analyze that and think about, actually, that's really interesting, that's really challenging. Of course they're not. You know, 11-year-olds are barely out of primary school. So it's really problematic for me that teachers are teaching these sorts of texts in those younger age groups and claiming that despite the fact that they have these issues, that they're still able to teach them productively. I don't think that's true. And ultimately, the excuses teachers gave us for why things are being taught, lots of teachers acknowledge the problems. And to be fair, and I will say this, it's really important, we're not here to shame and blame teachers. A lot of teachers told us, I have to teach what I've been told to teach. And also, lots of teachers talked about money. I have to teach the books that we've got in the cupboard. We can't afford to buy new texts. Other teachers talked about needing to teach something that was preparing students for GCSE. So they're teaching old GCSE texts. When we actually look at the statistics, a lot of the books being studied, about a third of the texts being studied were written after the year 2000, they're contemporary texts. So those texts have been bought at some point. Choices have been made about buying books. Lots of schools are also teaching very contemporary texts, you know, Carnegie winning, award winning books that have been published in the last few years. So there is money to buy new texts. But what's interesting is that even with contemporary texts, teachers are still defaulting to male authored. And what we believe really that, I mean, we don't have concrete evidence on this, but I think the evidence sort of speaks for itself, is that teachers choose overwhelmingly books with male characters and male protagonists because of the perception that boys don't like to read. And therefore, in order to engage the boys in their classroom, they have to choose a text with a boy at its centre. So even in a mixed school where you've got girls and boys together in the classroom, the perceived need to engage boys is prioritized over any perceived needs of girls. Girls are expected to just read and enjoy whatever's put in front of them, but boys need to be given their own perspective in a way that girls don't. And that for us is really troubling. And that kind of implicit belief is so there, I think, in so many people's minds, so many teachers' minds, that they're not even aware that they're thinking like that. And so that's why the change is really hard to happen, because a lot of teachers look at these statistics and they genuinely, that they kind of don't really see the problem.
And I'm right in saying that you said that most of those English teachers are actually women as well, aren't they?
Yeah. So I contacted the Department of Education to get statistics, and 77%, this was a couple of years ago, so the statistics might have changed slightly, 77% of teachers of secondary school English teachers are female, which is the largest proportion of female teachers in any subject. It's even more than, I think, primary schools. So it's a hugely female dominated profession. You also obviously within that have a lot of heads of department that are female, though it's actually not, it's more likely to be sort of more 50-50, because any man who becomes an English teacher is more likely to rise to a leadership position than a woman, another issue. So even when women are leading departments and they are making choices about curriculum, they are still defaulting to male-authored texts, which just goes to show how deeply male bias and patriarchy is embedded in all of us. You know, we are all internalising the patriarchy all the time. You can't separate yourself from the world in which you live.
Apart from one of those books, I read all of those when I was at school. But I will say this, if we're talking about a love of literature, I never thought about who'd written those books. So a bit like, I never thought about it. What I knew was then when I read some of those books, I loved them. And then I went on, like we started with Animal Farm and I went on to 1984. And then in my own time, I read all of George Orwell's books. And then I'm, you know, one of my history teachers gave me Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South. He gave it to me as a prize. And then I went into all the 19th century women's literature when I was in, I think it was like year nine, and then I branched out into French literature. So I think the point that I'm trying to make is I can see what you're saying about society in general and about this sort of patriarchal approach to literature. But if you love literature, does it matter if it creates this love of reading that stays with you for the rest of your life? Or is there something much darker at play there that we're missing?
I think, you know, you make a very good point. And because of various circumstances over the course of history, certainly when you're looking at 18th and 19th century, there is the argument that a lot of the best, if we want to make a subjective of comment about literature, is male authored, because men had more opportunities to be educated and to be able to be in a position to write than women. So I do accept to a certain extent, not wholly, but I do accept to a certain extent, there are periods of time in our history of literature that students, if you want to show them the best of what is thought and said, if I want to be all Matthew Arnold on us, we, you know, that there are male authors are the best candidates for those periods of history. But I think really when it comes to developing a love of literature, there are so many fantastic male authors out there who absolutely should be read, and absolutely we should be encouraging students to read and explore. You know, 1984, for example, is an absolute classic, and I think if you want to understand something about dystopian literature, you absolutely have to read that, and I think that's really important. I'm not a fan of Charles Dickens, so I won't go there. But there are, you know, so many wonderful novels that I agree we should be putting in students' hands. But the problem is when we give a preference or to those male authors, and we don't balance the curriculum with also looking at women of equal quality. Because if we choose to just populate our curriculum with those classic male novelists, the implicit message we're sending to our students is this is the best. And the best is male, and also problematically, the best is white. And there is no other, you know, there are also some women who are writing at this time, but you can go out and discover them in your own time, as you had to do when you were at school. And that relies on students having a passion and an interest in literature to go away and do that work themselves. Unfortunately, a lot of students don't have that passion for literature, but also, you know, the world is a much more distracting place these days. Students are always online, they're on social media, etc. So expecting them to engage with hefty works of classic literature at home in their own time, I think is perhaps these days unreasonable. And for me, I think what's so important is that we give students a choice, we give students a plethora of options which they can then use to go off as a jumping off point to go and explore what interests them. If we don't give them the option to read women in the first place, we're not doing our jobs properly, because we're not giving them an accurate depiction of what the landscape of literature really looks like. For me, you know, I'm a Victorianist, that's what I've got my master's in literature wise. It would be a crime to teach 19th century literature without teaching a Bronte novel, without teaching an Austen, without teaching Gaskell, without teaching Eliot. You know, these women are giants of the 19th century, and they are also giants of the history of literature. And erasing them from the curriculum because, you know, while Charles Dickens is more interesting or exciting or shorter, Silas Marner is also really short by George Eliot. So, you know, you could teach that instead. The Professor by Charlotte Bronte, not her best novel, admittedly, but it's also very short. Agnes Grey by Anne Bronte is also very short and a fantastic piece of work. It just takes a little bit of creativity and a bit of imagination to think a little bit more widely about what is classic literature, what is good literature, what is important. And a lot of the main male novelists who people choose, not necessarily because they're male, but they choose because they are considered to be the perfect example of a particular type of literature. So, for example, 1984 is a perfect example of dystopian literature. Well, there are also a lot of prominent 19th century female writers who were also writing dystopian literature that you could also teach alongside that. So you don't, it's not necessarily about either or, and it's not necessarily about saying we need to get, because lots of people say to us, well, you know, what do you want to do? You just want to get rid of men off the curriculum then? Absolutely not. You know, we can have balance. We can teach them alongside each other. So why not compare 1984 with a similar novel by a female writer? Why not compare a Charles Dickens novel with a Gaskell novel, for example? Because that would also give you a really interesting way of looking at the difference in urban London compared to urban Manchester in the 19th century. You're able to make much more interesting connections, but you're also able to see how the same issue is perceived from a male perspective and a female perspective. And I think that is what is really key and what is missing in our classrooms when you don't allow students to read books written by women about women. You are missing 50% of the experience of a particular period of time, and often women's experiences are more domestic, and that's considered to be less interesting, less important, when actually the vast majority of our lives pass within the domestic sphere, and nothing is more important than the domestic sphere, because what's most important to us is our families and our relationships with each other. Hardly any of us, thank goodness, would experience war, for example, would experience fighting in a war. Why do we end up reading so many books about war and fighting when for so many of us, that's not our experience? The majority, 99% of our lives is spent inside our own heads and with our emotional relationships with other people. And books set within the domestic sphere, such as Jane Austen, who does mention war, by the way, because all of her novels, apart from Sanditon, were written during the Napoleonic Wars. So war is in the background, if you look for it, are set within the lives of people who are living lives very similar to us today, and we can learn a huge amount from that. And suggesting that those novels are less valuable because of the women's lives that they depict also reinforces that idea that women's lives are less valuable, less important, and have contributed less to the history of mankind, which quite frankly is nonsense. But it's a message we keep reinforcing by continuing to place male writers on a pedestal. And that's my very long-winded response to that, because that invisibility of women is what leads to misogyny. It's what leads to people thinking women aren't important, women don't do anything, women don't contribute anything, women don't. I mean, the amount of students who say to me, yeah, but women didn't work in the 19th century. Like, upper class women didn't, but 90% of the population were working. If you read a book by a woman, you'd know that, but they don't. So they don't see it. And all of that is what leads to this culture of girls being less important, girls being objectified, girls being treated as, you know, sexual objects, sexual fantasies, and essentially abused, harassed, etc., within their own school environment, which, as Debbie said earlier, is just reflective of the wider world outside. And Debbie has said this earlier as well, it's a drip, drip, drip. This isn't a sexy cause talking about books and, you know, what kids read in classrooms, but it's all part of this bigger picture of a gradual message that is being sent every minute of every day inside your classroom. You don't talk about women, you don't read anything about women, you don't see anything from a woman's perspective, therefore women aren't important, therefore I can treat women like crap. And that, unfortunately, is where we're at right now.
And I would just add to that boys aren't born sexist. No. I mean, they don't, you know,
they learn.
They basically don't sexually harass girls in a vacuum. They learn these behaviours, and they learn that these behaviours get them power and control, and there's no consequence within the system. So why wouldn't they behave that way? You know, they grow up never hearing women's voices. They never read or discuss women's experiences. No. They never learn to value women. And it's just no surprise, really, that they grow up with all of those and so little respect. And my day job is I work in a hospital, and it's my job is all about improving the systems and processes, and I see so many parallels with this. And one of the one of my favorite things that we quote in my day job is that every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it does. And I think that that's true of society and schools. But, you know, we've basically mirrored what goes on in society and schools in a mini micro way. And we've basically designed schools which perfectly get the results they're designed to, which is to reproduce. I think schools reproduce patriarchy, and they reproduce male privilege and power. Because Ofsted basically said that boys have a sense of superiority and it makes them feel they can treat girls as they wish. Well, where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know.
And it's in every academic subject. And, you know, English is just the tip of the iceberg. English is easy to count. It's easy to see in English because you can see who the author of a book is. You can see who the protagonist is. It's much more insidious in other subjects. Mm. Difficult to count, difficult to quantify. So that's also something that you can get away with quite easily. But, you know, something I will say that's very obvious in English is, and something to defend my colleagues, is that many of my teaching colleagues, English teaching colleagues, know that the books they're teaching are misogynistic. And many of them use that misogyny as a jumping off point to talk about these issues. So I think teachers are doing their best to teach within the confines of what they've got. But what we as an organisation really want to push English teachers to do is to think more broadly than that and have the bravery and take the risk to actually change the text themselves. Because you can have much more productive discussions about misogyny and patriarchy when you're reading a book written by a woman from a woman's perspective, rather than reading a book by a man that's writing about a woman from a man's perspective. That's an interesting perspective, but it's the perspective that our whole world is built on already. So let's have something different in our classrooms.
So yeah, there is something darker at play with your question. Because what might seem like a minor issue, that women are invisible, we don't read books by and about women in schools, but actually the invisibility of women in the school curriculum is one of the reasons that it's along the spectrum. It's one of the drivers as to why we live in a world where there's violence against women and girls, and why that's routine. And you can't solve the one without the other, yeah. Even though it might seem trivial on its own, but it isn't.
What then are your recommendations and the next steps?
One of the problems that we face is that people and wider organisations such as Ofsted see misogyny as being a social issue, and therefore they see it as being a PSHE problem. So it's something that you tackle in PSHE. We'll teach a couple of lessons on that. We'll teach about consent. The big focus at the moment is on consent, which is absolutely very important. We're not denigrating that at all. It's really important that students understand how to have healthy sexual relationships. But there's a sense that once you've done a couple of lessons on consent, you've done a couple of lessons on healthy relationships, you've ticked the misogyny box, and then you don't have to think about it again. It's much like doing, you know, Black History Month at school. Well, we'll just forget about race for the rest of the year then, shall we? It's performative, and it's box ticking, and it's not really looking at what the structural issues are. Because if you walk out of that PSHE lesson and then go back into every other academic lesson and all you're hearing is about men all the time, that couple of lessons on consent is going to do absolutely nothing. Mm. It's just putting a plaster on a gaping wound. Mm. So it's for us, the change has to happen with schools recognising that it's the academic content of their curriculum that needs to be tackled alongside the PSHE, alongside the lessons on sexual harassment and consent. They need to connect the dots between the two. So that is really what we're pushing for. English specifically, what our recommendations are to teachers is to make slow changes. What we recognise is obviously money is tight at the moment. We do have to recognise that. And money's tight for parents as well as schools. So a lot of schools ask students to buy their own texts, and asking students to buy a brand new text for £10 every time you're teaching a new book, for some parents that is too much. And we do recognise that. So what we say to schools is, if you can just change one book a year, making those slow incremental changes, or if you can't change the book, if you're not in a position to change what you're teaching, change the way that you teach it and the way that you talk about it, and make sure you're having those explicit conversations. And, you know, something I used to say to my students, which probably my head of department at the time didn't appreciate, was, I don't like this book. I don't like the fact that I'm teaching this book. I feel uncomfortable teaching this book because I find it misogynistic, and that's how I'm going to teach it to you. And being very upfront with it. You know, this might be a great piece of literature, but the messages it sends are problematic, and we are going to talk about that. I don't want you to go away passively thinking this is a really good piece of work, because it's not. So we can have those conversations, and we can absolutely respect the intelligence of our students in being able to engage with those. But outside of English, we also have wider systemic bodies that we are trying to challenge, and part of that is exam boards.
The key point is, no one thing will make a difference. No. There isn't a single silver bullet. As Rachel says, PHSE alone is not enough. It's a good thing to do, but it needs to be supported by the other things that go alongside it. And as she says, you know, you it's what they actually, you've got to look at what they spend most of their everyday time on, and it's not PHSC, it's the everyday taught curriculum in which women are pretty much invisible. So they have to change that, and that won't happen alone. It won't happen, you can't leave it to schools alone. We need exam boards to change the books that they put on those, so that they need to take away the old choices, so that schools are forced to change, and they need to incentivize them to choose different things. And actually, parents, students, teachers, we all have to lobby for that change, because people, organizations tend to stick with the status quo. They only change most of the time when they're forced to. So, you know, we need to be doing that, but we also need to be looking at all the other fronts, like girls having access to all sports. You know, lots of girls who might want to play football struggle to do that. We know that there's a campaign, there are campaigns going on around that. And as I say, playground space is relevant. I have a bugbear around the terminology used to describe teachers. So I hate the fact that in secondary schools it's sir and miss, and I don't think that those terms are equivalents. You know, you can be a 21-year-old just out of teacher training college. If you're a male and you're a sir, you're elevated overnight. And you can be a 59-year-old teacher retiring in, well, these days it's another 7 years, but you know what I mean, retiring soon, and you're still a miss. And miss is basically, you know, represents a woman who is really no power in practice. And teachers, some teachers say to me, why does it matter? Why does it matter? I don't mind. But I might. They need to mind on behalf of the message that it sends students, that men are more important than that status. And those things do matter. And I don't know about if people have heard of the TV programme that it was a two-part a few years ago called No More Boys and Girls, and it was actually about primary schools, and it's really fantastic. You can watch it still on YouTube. It's really good. But it showed that teachers in primary schools making really small changes, which didn't cost money, but it was about the way the teachers' behaviours, had a really massive impact. But the outcome was that girls had much more confidence, and boys were able to show more emotions and were a bit more balanced in their, you know, they were able to deal with, you know, not being the best at something in the past. They might have had a tantrum. All of the children benefited. You know, and Ofsted should be inspecting schools for equality. So those are the kinds of changes we'd like to see. There is no one of those changes alone will be enough. We need all of them to happen. And I'm sure there are lots of others. But
and I think as well, something that's quite a big one for me is we need to move away from being performative. And we need to stop thinking that by doing a week or a month or a particular theme or something means that we've tackled something, because it's not. If you're, for example, what really bothers me in a lot of the research we did with Key Stage 3 was that schools would do a unit in year 7 on women's writing, as if women are some kind of weird subset of the population. There's only five of us. And we've got some strange culture that needs to be studied. It's like, we are 51% of the population. Why have we got a unit on us? What, and the rest of the time we're not going to be featured? It's bizarre. So that kind of thinking needs to change. I've just done a research report into Key Stage 4. And what we found there was that there is a sort of, in some of the exam boards, on some of the modules, there is an almost 50-50 female-male split. So on paper, it looks like we're making the exam boards are providing choice. But the reality is, when you look at those choices, for example, you've got A Christmas Carol and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, both of which are under 100 pages, on the same set text list as Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, which Jane Eyre is about 600 pages and Pride and Prejudice is about, you know, nearly 400 pages. Why on earth would teachers choose those female authored texts that are so long over the shorter ones? It's not actually a choice. However, the exam boards can say that they are providing equality. So it's also digging a little bit underneath the surface there and looking at the reality of what equality is being presented to us as. And unfortunately, a lot of exam boards are using clickbait headlines, making claims about equality and diversity. When you actually look at the statistics, over 80% of students are studying in Spectacles and A Christmas Carol for both of their texts, and none of those other choices are getting a look in. And the exam boards are doing nothing about it, and they are adding new texts by women and by writers of colour, but they are not taking away those texts that they know teachers will keep choosing. And the reason why they're not doing that is because they don't want people to move away from using their exam board. They are putting profits over social justice. And that for me is completely wrong. We are here as teachers to create a generation of the next generation. We are here to build character and to build fairness in a just and equal society. And if we're not modelling that in the content of what we're teaching, then why are we here?
You must feel that you're banging your head against a brick wall on a regular basis. So, you know, what can you do to get those exam boards to change? How can you, you know, implement all these things that you're talking about without them just paying lip service to you? Where do you sit on that? Where do you go with that?
So that's what our campaign aims to do, is to try and bring some visibility to the problem and to try and help people understand why it matters, and also to find allies out there. Because when I started off the campaign, I was a secondary school parent, and unlike primary school, I didn't know who the other parents were. And I knew that there'd be allies out there who thought what I thought, but I didn't know how to find them. So one of the things is finding others who share the same views, who we, and then working together in a coordinated and way to demand change. But as I say, we have to have change at different levels. So I don't know at the moment what's stopping exam boards making changes. I mean, I don't think there's anything. There's nothing in the law that stops them making changes. We need to be lobbying MPs. We need to be doing all those things. I think the problem is indifference. One of the things that I worry about is that people that don't think this stuff matters, they don't think Sir and Miss matters, they don't think the author and protagonist of books really matter. I think there's a normalisation and trivialisation of sexism everywhere, not just in schools. Mm. Schools are no different. And it makes it difficult to call it out, because any one thing on its own can be easily dismissed and seem trivial. You know, whilst apparently we have to all fight the more important battle of whatever men think is more important. It's really important to make the link between all of this small stuff and the violence against women and girls. But as I said before, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens within the context of the normalisation of everyday sexism.
The focus is too much on the end result, and it's not on looking at the root cause. Mm. And that for us is, and unfortunately, the root cause, as we've been saying, it's not headline grabbing. It's not sexy. It's going to take time to change. It is a slog. It's not something that is a quick fix. Yeah. And I think that's the problem that we face, is that a lot of people want to look at a problem and they want to do something about it, and then they want to see a result. And trying to challenge patriarchy isn't going to be something that we can just do just like that. It is going to be slow, systemic change, and it's going to rely on allies coming forward and people working together, in voices coming together and campaigning together and putting pressure on those organizations and coming together and saying that they care. And I think part of the problem is a lot of people do care, but they don't know where to start, or they see the problem and they think it's too big. There's nothing we can do about this. And so we end up with nothing ever changing. Like you said yourself, Susan, the books that we talk about were books that you did at school. And, you know, it's the same with my parents did the same books at school. We looked at a wonderful book by Dale Spender, who was an education academic, who was writing about these sorts of issues back in the 1970s. And she listed exactly the same books back then. So things aren't changing, and it feels like too big a problem. But the reality is, we can make change if we have enough people who are willing to stand alongside us and call for that change with us. And I think it is quite hard for secondary school parents in particular, because as Debbie says, you do lose that school gate connection. So it's about us finding ways to develop community and bringing people together, and also moving beyond this being a woman's issue, because it's not just a woman's issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a parent myself, but I have three teenage nephews who I adore, and I want them to have a world where they don't feel that they have to be macho, that they don't feel like they have to be this kind of, like, you know, violent, aggressive boy in order to be considered valid or to be accepted in social circles. I want a world where boys can feel as free to stay at home and bring up their children as women do. I want a world where boys feel free to, you know, talk about their emotions and to cry and do all of those sorts of things. We need to build a world that's fair and just for everybody. And I think for us, what would be really helpful, and I, you know, is having more men share their concern about what's happening in schools, because as long as this remains something that only women are talking about, it gets marginalized. That's the reality. So having more people from different backgrounds coming together and saying, actually, yeah, I see that this is a problem and we need to make change, it is what we need. So that's, if anybody listening who cares and who wants to get involved, you know, please contact us, because we can't do this by ourselves.
We do get people volunteering. So when they see stuff that we've published, we, you know, it generates some interest. We have authors. We've got an author who's contacted us who we're hopefully going to be doing some work with. We aim to work with other organisations. We're not trying to duplicate what anyone else already does. So there are organisations out there that already go in and do diversity and equality training with schools. So there's UK Feminista, there's Bold Voices, there's Equality. So there are others as well. Yeah. And our aim is that they would take material that we produce. So the lesson plans, we have actually already produced, Rachel has already produced six schemes of work for two books for year seven, two for year eight, two for year nine, intersectional, covering intersectionality. And
we've also made connections with the NUT and the NASUWT. Mm-hmm. We actually presented our findings at the NASUWT Women's Conference last year, which was a wonderful opportunity to network with teachers. And we plan on expanding those connections with the unions, because the unions have that voice amongst teachers. They recognise that this is an issue and they're very keen to work with us on this. We've also done some really good work with the English teaching organisations, in particular, so NAET, the National Association for Teaching of English. We're also working with universities. So I've done a few CPDs with initial teacher training courses at a couple of universities. And that's also something that we want to build on. The problem is, you know, we all work full time. You know, I'm a teacher myself, so it's hard to fit it all in, but we are making as many connections as we can. And as the campaign, I mean, we only started this campaign 3 years ago, barely three years ago. So we've already made big strides forward and people are hearing about us, and we are starting to get more people just sort of hearing about us on, we've been in the Guardian, we're on the radio quite often, so people are hearing about us and contacting us. There's certainly a move, I think, starting to show with those larger organizations that support teachers that this is an issue, but it's getting into the organizations that aren't traditionally seen as supporting teachers, such as the exam boards and also Ofsted, that are proving more problematic. But you know, it's we're at an early stage.
I'm sure people will want to find out more. So can you just wrap up by telling us how they can get involved with the End Sexism movement?
Yeah, so basically we'll be looking for more crowd researchers. We're working currently on history. Our history subgroup teachers have already designed a questionnaire, so we're trying to quantify the extent of teaching about women in school history. We've nearly finished testing it. So we'll be looking for crowd researchers.
And that's quite an interesting job, actually, finding out what schools are teaching.
If there are any authors out there, we're going to be doing some more collaborations with authors. So we're going to be seeking authors. We would like to move on and look at other subjects, but we need subject matter experts in those to help get going. And we need a critical mass before it's practical. So if you're an expert or a teacher in a particular subject and you'd like to try and help form a subgroup to do work on that, we'd like to do that. We're always looking for some fundraisers. We're about to set up as a charity. We're in the process of working our application up. So if you've got skills in governance, we'd love some help. Yeah, those are the kinds of things we're looking for support on. And but, you know, even people who've just got a bit of time to help, you know, there's still administration and things that need to be done around the campaign. So people have usually got something, some skill set that's of use to us. So the main thing is just to get in touch if they think they can help. And our website is endsexisminschools.org.uk, and they can message us there, or they can contact us via Twitter, and our Twitter handle is @NoSchoolSexism. We have an onboarding process with volunteers, and so we'll take them through that and work with them to see how they can help.
It's been an absolute pleasure, so thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Independent Teacher Podcast. If you like listening to this podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.